This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2018, held at Faith Builders on July 31 to August 3.
Okay, I think we'll get started. I guess I shouldn't give a disclaimer, but this topic was intended to fill out a schedule of breakouts, and it's my current work. I'm working for Stewardship Resources, which is a division of Anabaptist Financial, and part of that is teaching stewardship and finances. We have a basic young family finance seminar and a budgeting seminar. We also have a seminar for deacons, financial advisors, and trustees, and we are, as of a few weeks ago, starting to launch the idea of school curriculum, an actual stewardship curriculum for our schools. So the first phase of that is underway this school year, being written and hopefully piloted by the end of the school year. We're unsure if how fast we can work on that. That is a 30-lesson course, and so it's intended to be very basic, written at an eighth grade level, and it will be, I would just say the very basics of stewardship. Beyond that, we're hoping that we can produce a half-year high school course, but we're going to go one step at a time. And so what you're hearing today is kind of a mishmash of what we teach in our family finance seminars. But one of the things that I think about quite often when we're teaching about stewardship, we're really encountering attitudes and what has formed that person from a very young age. A lot of these stewardship attitudes are developed and ingrained at a very young age, and I think you as a teacher, you form them knowingly or unknowingly. You probably don't think about, I'm teaching this child about stewardship, but stewardship is an area, or stewardship finances is an area where the real person is manifested, so to speak. They live out what they believe. So thinking about stewardship, a picture definition, first of all, we have God, we have His created world here, and we have His stewards. And so in terms of man's relationship to God, John Koblenz has done a really good job of helping us see it's love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That is the primary commitment or commandment there. God's relationship to the earth, He is the creator. Psalms tells us the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And then stewardship really comes into this relationship where we have provision and stewardship. Man's relationship with the material world around us, in terms of the material world, does provide for us the resources around us, the crops we cultivate, the things we eat are a provision that God has granted, and it comes to us via His created resources, the material world. And then reverse, man has been given the opportunity and the privilege to steward, to care for, to take care of that created world that God has in a lot of ways put under our control, in our domain. And so we're to have dominion and fill the earth. Maybe just one thing here, this provision and stewardship relationship, that's what makes science class really important, because it would be interesting, or it will be interesting to see. The world around us is changing so rapidly. The population of the world is going up dramatically. And man is in a race, really, to feed himself. And so you talk with anyone in agriculture, it is different than it was 50 years ago. And that somewhat comes out of a need for more production so that we can simply feed the people in the world. A word definition, stewardship is using God-given resources. That's what we're doing. Why we're doing it, we're doing it to do God's will, where we're doing it, in His world, and among His people. Now, this is maybe more of a flashy explanatory definition, whereas a more functional definition would simply be that a steward takes care of someone else's things. The things that we have been given charge of really are not our own. And that ownership attitude takes root very early in a child's life. So let's think about God-given resources. And this is where your second handout comes in. I don't expect you to be able to read all of that. Just trying to break down what are the resources at our disposal. And I don't think we'll go over this in detail, but if you want to talk to your students about what stewardship is, at least define it in a broad sense. What has God actually given to us? Maybe you do this as a devotional, an opening some morning. And I think time really helps us to think about stewardship in a better way, maybe, than what financial resources does. Because with time, we all have it, okay? And actually, we all have it in equal amounts. And as soon as you start talking about stewardship and finances, everyone wants to compare. Well, you know, this stewardship applies to that guy. He's so rich. He won't listen. It really applies to the family over here that's struggling, because they really need to budget and scrape by, you know, their school teachers and that kind of thing. And so stewardship really applies to them. And so when we get over to the treasure, the financial aspect of stewardship, we kind of tend to immediately put ourselves out of the picture and point fingers elsewhere. But you know what? Time, we all have it. We all have equal amounts of it today. And so there's no choice. God has given that to you. And I don't think there's anyone here who is spited about that, because the other alternative is not, you know, if you don't have time, you don't have life. And so starting with time, I think, is a good idea when we think about a resource that God has given. And the interesting thing there is we don't know the total amount that we have. And we don't know when God will take that back from us. Talent would be another one. We all have it. And here, we don't all have the same kind. And you'll see this in your classroom. It can be used for mutual benefit, because the strengths of one person can be utilized in certain ways. The strength of another student can be utilized in different ways. We need it in our communities. We need, you know, administrators. We need the servant-hearted. We need the giver. And so just the way a person is oriented is a God-given resource. Just two scriptures there. Paul, talking to Timothy, talks about stirring up the gift. You know, this is one area where I think we can be encouraged to develop that resource. We exercise, when we exercise the God-given gift that we have, it can grow that resource, so to speak. And in the stewardship parables, we're told to grow what God has put into our care. Treasures, we all have or use it. I think all of us use money just about every day of our life in some way, shape, or form. I probably spent money today. Well, it is the first of the month, so my mortgage got paid. I didn't have to do anything to say that should happen. It happened automatically. And so, we may be spending money and don't even think about it. Certainly, we don't all have the same amount here. And treasure is a means to work, earn, provide, and give. And the challenge here is that Jesus does say, where your treasure is, there will your hearts be also. And thinking about the devotional this morning, I think that's where you as a teacher stand as an influencer of stewardship. You have access to the hearts of your children at a very young age. They're impressionable. And if you can get that heart geared and pointed in the right direction, it will affect everything in the student's life, not just stewardship. Okay, any questions or comments about this? I know we didn't cover it completely, but just trying to give some categories for you to think about stewardship. We didn't know where to put teamwork. That's why we put it down on the bottom, kind of off to the side. teamwork is extremely important, because when you get people and resources together, it takes teamwork. But teamwork in and of itself isn't really a hard commodity. It's not really a resource, but it certainly comes into play when we're thinking about working together as a community, as a brotherhood, in a school classroom. Okay, another rendition, and sorry, this green text isn't very visible. Just thinking about stewardship as a wheel with a hub. We have the hub in the center here. Each spoke could represent resources, and you can think about all kinds of resources. Time or heritage, treasure. If you have older students, they might actually have a vehicle. They might have animals at home. These are all resources, so maybe breaking down into actual things that they can connect with. God's Word, actually one of the few passages in the New Testament that talks about us being stewards, is in 1 Peter, and the context is that we are stewards of God's Word. And I believe it's 1 Peter 4:10. And so that certainly is very important. I would just point out here, in my experience, students get very interested about health class, and it always intrigued me why they liked health class so much. And I think the obvious answer is, it applies to me. And they start realizing that the way I brush my teeth actually is important. My teeth are oriented up and down, and so I should brush up and down instead of, you know, back and forth. And they become aware of things that they just were never aware of before. I think it was third grade in our school where they started health. And so stewardship of the body, God has given us our body, and caring for that in an appropriate way is maybe a way, again, to connect stewardship to your students in maybe a more real sense than the financial sense. Now, the point here, another point that could be made, is stewardship is like steering. We have the hub and the wheel, and I would like to think of the hub as being the heart here. And when Jesus says, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also, I would like to think about the way you steer. Okay, you get in your car, and when you turn the steering wheel, okay, it turns the hub on your car, which then turns the wheel, right? That's the way steering is supposed to work, from the inside out. And so thinking about the hub there being the heart, it is possible that you're going down the road and you hit something and steering works reverse, right? It works the opposite way. All of a sudden, your wheel is turned and it's out of your control. And when the hub and the wheel are not aligned, we have big problems. And I think thinking about stewardship and finances with older people, this is where I tend to get frustrated, because people get older and they just get more keen at skirting the real issues, I think. And too many of us old people tend to neglect the fact that the wheel and the hub are always aligned. Okay, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And we try to act like it's not what it is. We try to act like it doesn't need to be this way, or I'm the exception to the rule. And so when the hub and the wheel are not aligned, there is problems, and that could be one of them. I couldn't quite figure this picture out. I think he was actually driving on what we would consider the sidewalk, and he fell off the curb, and that was not a good thing. So the hub and the wheel aren't aligned. That signals problems. All right, God's will. Thinking specifically about the diagram and some of the relationships here, what is God's will for the material world? And I know this is a big picture flyover. You know, when God created this earth, this world, what were his purposes? And we don't have time even to give scripture to this necessarily, but from Psalms we see many places, it's to declare his glory. I think God's intent for us, when we walk out into his created world, is that we would be in awe, that we would be astounded at his glory, and then that we would in turn return praise. He gave it to provide for his stewards, certainly the material resources given to Adam there in the garden were for him to cultivate and to keep so that it would be his provision. And then after the fall, and we have sin entering into the system here, it's very interesting. You know, the passage in Romans talks about the whole creation is groaning, okay? And we see that all around us. As I get older, I think it seems to be getting worse. It's not just people and our problems in our fallen world. This whole creation is groaning. Think about the oil industry. You ever think about the fact that we could run out of oil? I did some calculations, and we pump, forget the exact number of barrels of oil, but if you put the oil we pump out of the earth in 1 year's time, put it in tankers and line them up at the equator, it goes around the earth more than one time. No, sorry, it was more than that. I think it was between one and two times. So you line up tanker trucks at the equator, the amount of oil we pump out of the earth would go more than one time. It was, I think, closer to two times around the earth. And that was 2015 statistics. So think about the earth, this created world. Man has come to this place where we can drill deeper, we can go farther, we can pull the resources out of this earth like we've never done before. And this whole creation is groaning, but God has promised to redeem and restore this world, and we know it's going to be destroyed by fire, as described there in 2 Peter, and then restored. God's will for mankind, we could say a lot here. We know that we were made in the image of God, and so that image-bearing capacity means that our actions should reflect God's purposes. If we're in His image, the things that we do should reflect Him. I think God is impressed in, I don't know if He's impressed, He finds joy in us discovering glory in His creation. When you have the opportunity to study the stars with your students, when you have the opportunity to catch a butterfly or whatever that is in your classroom, I think God finds joy when we find joy in what He has given and then return glory to Him. To declare His glory, it's interesting. This is maybe off the subject a little bit. When Paul encountered the heathens in Acts chapter 14, it's interesting how he looked at them and they had no framework or reference for thinking about who this God was that he was promoting. And you would see it in Acts 14 and also in Acts 27, 28 when Paul was on Mars Hill. But he talks about the creation, and he's saying in Acts 14 it's the idea that, well, there is this God, and He sends rain, and He gives us the seasons, and He gives us all of these good things, okay, the material part of this world, and therefore we should pay attention, okay? We should honor, glorify that type of God, that Creator God. And God's will is for us to love Him with all of our hearts and to be laborers together with God. God's will for man in relation to the material world, it's to receive God's provision. And, you know, God provides for us through the material world. When we look at what the material world has to offer us, so many people go at it like this. What can I get from that material world? And Romans 1 tells us how that very quickly turns into idolatry, where we worship and serve the creature more than the Creator. What can I get out of this created world for my own pleasure, my own entertainment, my own good, so to speak? But God wants us to receive that provision, to see that what He has given to us materially is His gift to us, and He has given it to us through the material resources of this earth. if you have been given a gift, if you have not taken what you deserve, but you've been given it, the only proper response then is joy and thanksgiving. And now we're getting down to some of the things that apply to your classroom, because your students are not naturally joyful. Well, maybe some of them are, you know, some of them are, but they're not naturally thankful. And that's a big deal, especially looking at Romans chapter 1. Thankfulness is a big deal in God's perspective. And the failure to give thanks in the passage here in Romans leads man to an end. It leads us to the world that we live in today, all kinds of sin, because we have ignored the Creator and we have worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator. And we're to take responsibility as a proper caretaker. We are to replenish the earth, subdue it, have dominion over it, and that assumes work, okay? And so work is not a bad thing. I know that your students might think that. They may not like work, but work is not part of the curse, okay? Work existed before man fell into sin. And so it got harder. Yes, there's weeds. I don't know if there were mosquitoes and bugs and things like that that bit you and made you itchy before the fall. But certainly work in and of itself is not a bad thing. And again, we're fighting a larger cultural thing here that says, you know, the more you can get for less, or the less you have to work is better. And that's not correct. All right, stewardship tests. Well, let's just stop there. We kind of went through the whole diagram now, took it apart. What comments do you have? And is that clock right? Okay. We're close enough to right. Okay. Any comments on the diagram or how it applies in your classroom?
I just mentioned before you go on, not really a lot to add, but I was just kind of struck that this kind of goes along with what I was thinking of making my classroom theme this year. And I was thinking of encouraging them somehow to put their all into the work that they do and the things that they do. And so, I don't know, this just seems like some good ideas here on how to present it as a stewardship of talent and things that God gives them, so it's great.
Yeah, if any of you want this or other resources, I don't mind to share with you. My email address is up there. It's lylemusser@gmail.com. So I was fortunate enough to get my own name with Gmail behind it. Okay, thinking about stewardship and how it tests our belief about God, some of these ideas are actually new to me, just thinking about what are the very underlying issues here. Is God the creator of all things? Is he the giver of all things? Is God good? Is God just? Is God sovereign? And we shouldn't even probably put question marks behind that, because that's foundational to what we believe, okay? And I think we would answer all of those questions as yes. Now, what in the world does that have to do with stewardship? Well, if God is the creator of all things, then all the resources in the world belong to my Heavenly Father. And he is the giver of all things. And so all the resources I have were given by his hand, not taken by my hand. And so this doesn't excuse us from working, but what are we running around fretting ourselves for, trying to build our own kingdom, little kingdoms, in terms of gaining and amassing more, when this is the bottom line reality of who God is and what he desires to give to us? Is God good and is God just? Well, yes, he's good, and his resources reflect his goodness. So when you eat ice cream or donuts or good peaches or blueberries or whatever, I think you should enjoy them, okay? That's his intent. And so that's one of the ways he communicates that goodness. Is God just? This one may be harder to swallow. If he is, and he is, then the amount of resources he has entrusted to me must be the right amount for me. And, you know, I know as school teachers we can go around, and I'm sure none of you are overpaid. It's just guaranteed, okay? You don't make more than what you should. But you know what? If it's enough for you, if it's meeting your needs, then it's right. And I think that there's good reason for teachers to have to sacrifice. You're setting an example in your community, and it really is an example of stewardship that maybe others are not living up to, but your students do appreciate and value and follow the example of the teacher. Is God sovereign? Well, yes, he's sovereign, and that says something about the supply. You know what? He knows everything. He knows my needs. It says something about security. If he is sovereign, there's no need to worry. And if he is sovereign, it says something about trust. You know, God has it under control. And trust, I think, is very critical in this discussion. Where do I have that? Okay, we're going to come up on it later, but when Paul instructed Timothy about what to tell the rich people, which we are, okay, you need to earn $33,000 a year to be in the top 1% of the world's wealthy, okay? So some of your high school graduates can get out of school, and before they're even married, if they're willing to work hard, they can be in the top 1% of the world's wealthy. Okay, so when we talk about the wealthy people, I know you're a poor school teacher, but you're actually very wealthy in terms of everything that's been given. And the danger is that we come to trust in that wealth. And so the idea that God is sovereign and we need to trust that no matter what economic situation we're in, that gets tested, especially when we're in a good economic situation. Now we're going to switch and look at stewardship attitudes. And what I want you to take from here is that there are two basic stewardship attitudes. There is a steward attitude and there is the owner attitude. And we're just going to work down through here and try to show that from these two basic attitudes come a whole list of other things that just kind of fall in line and are natural reflections of or natural outcomes of either a steward or owner attitude. So we'll set these in contrast a little bit. The steward attitude says everything I have is a gift from God. The owner attitude says everything I have is mine and I deserve it because I earned it. And so these are the two basic foundational attitudes when we think about stewardship. The steward keywords here are God's and gift. The keywords for the owner attitude are mine, I deserve, I earn, okay, me, myself, and I, get myself at the center. John's calling it the I-centric, or
I-Christian.
The I-Christian age. A term that I've been rolling around in my mind is the I-me-centric generation. It's really nothing new, but we have new technologies that come along and help us manifest that selfishness in different ways. So here we have the same thing manifested in stewardship. When does the owner attitude develop?
Since
born. Okay. They can tell you pretty quickly, even before a year old, what's mine and what you can take and what you can't take and what I deserve and what you're going to do for me. How long does it take to get rid of that? A long time. Okay, have children and you'll learn. I'm not there yet either, Okay, and so this is a growing process to take on this true stewardship attitude. Now, just some verses here. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein. And so we tend to think that we become, when we take possession of something, that we become the steward of it. And I would like to point out from this verse that it's clear here that God is the owner, and for us to become an owner of something, we actually rival God. Okay, when we begin to think about that thing as mine, and I deserve and I earn, in that sense we are rivaling God because He is the true owner. And so we don't take ownership, we receive from God's good hand. And so whether we're taking or receiving says a lot about how we see that resource. The owner attitude, this is maybe taken a little bit out of context, except that the illustrations that go along with this verse make it very plain. James says, "Do you think that the scripture saith in vain, the spirit that dwelleth in us lusteth to envy?" You know, the owner attitude has a voracious appetite for more. Okay, it's just natural in us to want more, bigger, better, and to increase that status or image or whatever that does for us. And so the context of these verses is conflict. So the question here is, how often does conflict arise over ownership issues? Okay, think about children dividing a parent's inheritance. Okay, you have a stewardship issue, and all of a sudden it highlights everything that's been under the surface for many years, right? All of a sudden it comes out. How does it come out? It comes out as a conflict in the sense of a stewardship issue, in the sense of ownership. In our work at Anabaptist Financial, passing on a business to the next generation, probably one of the most difficult things to do. Why? Because it involves this dance between stewardship and ownership. And so from the first generation to the second generation, it's fairly easy. From the second generation to the third generation is very, very difficult because the grandchildren now don't understand Grandpa's struggle to get the business started. They don't understand his vision for the business. And so we're getting off topic here, but it highlights this steward-owner attitude. Your classroom, who had the ball first out at recess, okay? We have a very practical ownership attitude. Whose turn is it to go first in the hot lunch line, okay? It will bring out all of this right and I deserve and I need this. Contentment and covetousness. Just setting these in contrast, contentment recognizes that everything he holds has been provided by the gracious hand of God and holds material resources with an open hand. Okay, if it's been given to him, he holds it like this. Covetousness, the covetous person sees his resources as a product of his hands, and therefore he holds them with a tight grip, like this. And we're, for the sake of time, going to skip over the verses here and go to this. So contentment holds resources with an open hand. I'm just pulling out a few of the key phrases here. How does this look in your classroom? And so I'm just throwing out one here. You might have others. You share with the one who forgot his lunch. Do we all forget sometimes? Yes. Well, if everyone else has, if we have 20 lunches here and one forgot, why not share, okay? We hold resources with an open hand. On the covetous side, I could think of the 7th and 8th grade example. What about that boy who bought the bat, which wasn't a good stewardship decision anyway? They make these baseball bats nowadays that are just crazy. You know, they hit the ball for you. You don't actually have to hardly swing and the ball just goes sailing. Okay, he paid $150 or maybe $300 for this bat, and he brings it to school, okay? You're going to have an ownership issue here, because he paid enough for it, he might not want anyone else to use it. So now you talk. How are you going to take care of that?
What about if the school mom says that nobody else needs her children's rollerblades?
Okay. Well, only one person can use the rollerblades at a time, so
yeah.
I guess the bat thing is the same.
It's fine, we gotta figure it out, but yeah.
Okay, so should that 7th grade boy be allowed to use his bat that he bought with his money and no one else can use it?
Seems like pride.
Okay, seems like pride.
Yeah, our school's had a policy for as long as I can remember since I was a student, I think that if you bring a sports equipment to school, it's everyone can use it, so I think
okay. That's
done well at addressing.
All right, so you actually have a policy already in place, or at least an understanding mm-hmm. That this is the way it is, okay?
Isn't it an unfair, like that boy with that bat had an unfair advantage over a lot of the others, right? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, they have the bounce, the BPF or whatever, so yeah, what actually happens in those things is the wall of the bat caves in a little bit and brings the ball out farther than, so yeah, he has an unequal advantage, so go ahead.
Well, I just think that right there, that would be something to address. I mean, it's not necessarily how God would want you to interact with in relationships with other people.
Mm-hmm. So what about when that boy gets older and he's ready to go into business and he finds a niche market that no one else has found out about yet? And he takes it and runs with it. He makes big money in a niche market and keeps everything quiet. Is that related to the baseball bat or not? Or is that different? Now we're in the real world. And I don't have the answer to that other than to show that the things that we deal with in these young children are real things that will come out later in life. Okay, contentment provides the environment in which relationships take precedence over doing and acquiring things. Covetousness puts the acquisition of things ahead of relationships, making it a common root cause of conflict related to finances. And so we have conflict over things. I like the phrase here, relationships take precedence. And so the idea here in contentment is it's people before accomplishments. We're not going to run over people to accomplish our goal. And the other example that just came to my mind, does this say anything about bragging up good grades? You know, why do students do that? Really bragging about anything. You know, my dad's stronger than your dad, my dad this, it depends what level of students you have. You know, the whole idea of I push you down to lift me up. And contentment says, no, relationships take precedence over that, you know, that status thing where I push you down to lift me up. Covetousness, did you ever watch 7th and 8th graders go to their locker? The acquisition of things very often takes priority over relationships. You know, they bang into each other and open lockers into each other, and you know, they're going for it. It's the owner attitude. So you can address that as it comes up. We're gonna skip that. Okay, Thanksgiving and complaining. Wanna take some time here. Thanksgiving is a logical response of a content steward because he finds joy in what God has provided. Was talking to Lauren Miller last night. I didn't realize that Lauren is a brother-in-law to Steve because their wives are sisters, but anyhow. Lauren would have started New Horizons Ministries, more recently been working in Thailand, and he was telling me about these homes in Thailand and across Asia, where the children are taken in by foster parents, usually pastor families, so that they're not trafficked, not sold, not exported. And so they take them in and care for them. And he said the one home, they were living on rice, they had rice for 2 months straight. And when everyone got, they took a half pound of meat, and Lauren sent them this meat in half pound packs, and it went around to like 28 people. So they all got like a little speck of meat. And he said they thought they were the richest people in the world. They got to eat meat. And he said they were begging him to share his testimony. And he said, no, I want to hear your testimony. And they were, he said, the most joyful and thankful people that you could find. He said they put children in America to shame. And so that's the idea of Thanksgiving. Here they had been given something, a little speck of meat, and their response was not, oh, we don't get this every day. Their response was joy in what God had provided. Complaining is a logical response of a covetous owner because he's never satisfied with the amount or quality of his things. You ever observe this? When someone has as much as they could ever want, then they switch, and it's not about the amount, now it's about the quality, right? And so, I better not start giving examples, but you can just way overdo it in those terms. Now, we're commanded in Scripture to give thanks. In fact, it's stated here in 1 Thessalonians, this is the will of God. And so, especially older students are thinking about, what's God's will for my life? What does God want me to do with my life? And, well, when you're searching for God's will, you start with what you know for sure. And here it is. So, number one, you want to know what God's will is for your life, start by being a thankful person. And if you start with the things that you know for sure, He will lead you from there. And then a passage there from Ephesians. Complaining, in Exodus 16, we're told how the children of Israel murmured against Moses, their complaining attitude. And then you come to 1 Corinthians, and Paul says, neither murmur ye as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. We don't have time to unpack these two passages, but it's interesting to look at them in tandem. You kind of have the Old Testament portion, and then you have Paul's comment on that after the fact. Just like John said this morning, we can interpret things much better when we look back and we see what happened in history. So here's a case in Scripture where you have Paul's interpretation of the story in Exodus, and it's very insightful. Okay, I think this is where the rubber meets the road, because your students know what Thanksgiving is, or being thankful, or saying thank you, and they know what complaining is. And so of all the stewardship attitudes, I think this is the most frequent attitude that you're going to encounter in the classroom. And so the question here is, how will you encourage Thanksgiving and counter complaining? So first of all, Thanksgiving, you find joy in what God has provided. Resources are a gift, so we should be thankful. Thanksgiving, or a lack of it, demonstrates what we think about God. And so now we're back to the whole idea of, is God just? Is God good? Is God sovereign? And our students at a young age aren't going to make that connection. But when we're unthankful, help them, walk them through, okay, your whatever it is, your backpack, your shoes, your lunchbox isn't good enough, or whatever it is, or the party that the teacher planned isn't as extravagant as they thought it should be, or they deserve 5 pieces of pizza at the pizza party instead of 2. Okay, so Thanksgiving, or a lack of it, demonstrates what we think about God. Help them, step them through that. Your unthankfulness, what does that say to the people around you? But more than that, what does that say about what God has provided? And an observation, having more does not make us more thankful. I think it makes us more complaining. The more we have, the more we tend to complain, and we're back to that amount and quality. Okay, if we don't complain about the amount, then we complain about the quality of our things. Complaining is contagious. It's much easier spread than Thanksgiving. So the natural route is going to be what you don't want. Okay, so and complaining is really questioning God's provision. When you're complaining about what God has provided, you're taking offense or attack on God. So talk with me here a little bit. Have any of you ever taken a proactive approach or sat down and tried to map out or plan out specific ways to help your students be thankful, or specific ways that you curb complaining?
We had reversions once, we had about thankfulness, and then just random times throughout the day, we had to, like, we kind of build an altar to God, and we had sticky notes, and then we just put them on the door.
Okay.
It was amazing how their attitudes over that time was trying to look what they're thankful for.
Mm-hmm. So just draw attention to it. Mm-hmm. Or maybe if you encounter complaining, maybe they're focused on the one thing that's not right. You could shift the focus and say, well, what about all the things that are right here? Let's be thankful. Okay? I don't have good ideas here. I do remember sitting down with some of my eighth graders and giving them a on-the-spot, spur-of-the-moment, off-the-cuff sermon out of 1 Corinthians about complaining. I don't know how I did there, because they were the kind of crew that needed to be called down and kind of told how it was. The interesting thing is, I think all of them go to our church now, and they're all getting grown up and getting married, and they're all pretty nice young men. And you never would have thought that about 6 or 8 years ago. They were a unique crew. Probably the kind that will be school board members in a few years when their children start coming to school, because they made things happen, and it wasn't always the best things that happened. Okay, anything more here? I would encourage you to think about this. This I think is the most root level daily thing that you're going to encounter in terms of informing. You're not directly teaching stewardship, but you're helping to form what they think about God's provision. And so thanksgiving and complaining is, I think, where the rubber meets the road. Temperance and excess. I think I'm going to skip over some of these. Okay, temperance, just to highlight here, a lifestyle of restraint and self-control, trusting the Lord and living within one's means. In any child's life, self-control is a huge thing, and hopefully they have mastered that by the time they come to you in first or second grade. But certainly children, and even us, we don't just have something fully mastered. But the whole idea of temperance here and self-control is very important. Think about this prayer from the book of Proverbs. This is the only prayer recorded in the book of Proverbs. And when I found that out, I just thought it was so appropriate. I envision saying this prayer something like you would say the Lord's Prayer, especially because we are so wealthy and spoiled. It's a prayer that kind of hits us where we're at. Two things have I required of thee. Deny me not them before I die. Remove far from me vanity and lies. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of my God in vain. So it recognizes that there is a danger on both ends of the scale. I don't think any of us would just desire to live in dire poverty, okay? There's challenges with that end of the spectrum. I think our challenge is much more on the other end of the spectrum where we say, you know what, God, it is possible that I would be full, I would have so much that I would deny you and say, well, who is the Lord? I got my life together. I can trust my wealth, I'm self-insured or whatever you are, and you just go on with life and you have all your answers tied up in your riches and wealth. Riches tend to lead to self-trust, self-fulfillment, and denial of God. And I think this passage does a very good job of reminding us of that. So if you want a prayer to add to your list of prayers, maybe you add this right on the end of the Lord's Prayer, or say the Lord's Prayer one day and say this prayer the next day, just to highlight that for your students. Moses' concern for the children of Israel when they went into the promised land was, beware that you don't forget the Lord. Beware. Why? Because you're going into a place of wealth. You're going into a place of plenty. And the challenge there in verse 14 is, lest your heart be lifted up and you forget the Lord your God. And so again, just the concept that in the presence of a lot, we tend to trust in the stuff instead of the giver. So in the excess of food, we tend to overeat. In the excess of leisure, we tend to get lazy. In the excess of money, we tend to overspend. In the excess of material wealth and pleasure, we tend to get spiritually weak. And so beware in situations of excess. And it might not be money or wealth excess. It may be other things. And I can think of two examples here that I'll give. In what situations do your students encounter excess and need to exercise temperance? We had a visiting minister come to our congregation a few months back, and he started out his message on temperance by saying that he was talking with an old lady in their congregation. I think she was in her 90s, and she asked him why we don't teach about temperance anymore. She said when she was young, it was required that once a quarter, four times a year, there would be a message on temperance. And this man admitted that the preacher admitted that he doesn't remember ever hearing a message on temperance. So he gave a very excellent, down-to-earth, practical message on temperance. Okay, so how does that apply? Well, field trips with spending money, where there's excess, where they have something at their control. My two examples here, we had a field trip where the children would go to a candy shop and parents empowered their children to buy more candy. Well, they assumed that they would buy the candy and put it in a bag and do like good children do and eat it, one piece a day or whatever. And some of them just, they didn't know what to do with, they had access to it and they had their friends' approval to eat more. And it was a shame, really. There was excess. And I remember a time where a girl went home and I was literally concerned about her when I heard how much sugar she had consumed. And I forget if I called the parents or not, but it was extreme, okay? It was excess. Help your students work through that. How many pieces of pizza does a 7th or 8th grader need to eat in Canada?
I don't know.
This goes in shifts and waves. When I had 7th and 8th graders, they were so interested in getting out to recess, they didn't care about the amount of pizza. But then you get a crew where they think it's cool to eat tons of pizza, they'll eat a whole pizza if you let them, okay? A situation where temperance is needed and excess needs to be discouraged. Or what if they're done with their work? They have excess time, okay? What do you do when you have excess time? Just whittle it away? Is that your time? What can they do with their excess time that would be of benefit or use? Okay, any examples that you have here?
Is there a hot lunch?
Okay.
Like, I have one that would eat in 3 servings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That reminds me, we had one particular hot lunch that they became tradition. And so students knew when this certain mom was there that there were these certain rolls, and they would just consume large amounts of them. And so we would have chapel in those days, so we would actually announce the limit in chapel. Okay. Lifestyle evaluation. This is a slide that we use in our Young Family Finance seminar, but thinking about the underlying realities, you know, people justify their purchases by this type of justification. Because your friends have it, I need it because my friends have it. Well, what does that say? It says that there's comparison going on here. Does that ever happen in your classroom? It happens all the time, okay? It's a human tendency, but help them work through that. What about this? Because I can afford it does not necessarily justify a purchase, okay? And so this is one that we really need to fight against. Just because you have the ability to do something doesn't necessarily mean that you should. And so here we have the idea that the ability justifies it. Well, I can, so I will. And in terms of stewardship and finances, that's not good logic. Status, social classifying, and elevated lifestyles will tear down brotherhood. And so here we have the idea we put others down to lift ourselves up, and that happens. I was going to say it happens in your classroom more than it does in the adult world, but it probably doesn't. We just are more sly at covering our tracks. All right, humility and pride fall in line with the stewardship and owner attitudes. And brotherhood and independence fall right in line with those stewardship and ownership attitudes. And I'm just going to wrap up with a few of the practical realities. For those of you that are teaching older students and you want to help them actually think through the next few years of their life, they're getting out of school, what does that mean in terms of stewardship of finances? And so this is a graph that we use at our seminars just to highlight the fact, and I think it originates from one of Gary Miller's books, or at least the concept. The blue line shows income over a person's lifetime. So as a child, a 10-year-old, okay, they're making very little money, and that blue line is going to increase. They're going to make more money till they come to an age where they can't work as much, and it's going to tail off. The gray line is their supposed expenses. And so this area right here, right after they get out of school, they have relatively low expenses and high income, which is actually kind of a dangerous place to put a child in, especially if they're not temperate. Okay, all of these things are woven together. We call that the opportunity of youth. Help them to see that they are entering into this place where they have an opportunity that is unprecedented. They have an opportunity from age 15, 16, 18 to marriage and setting up a household that is going to be an unprecedented opportunity that they're not going to have for a very, 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 very long time. And so they get married, start having children, and then income and expense are very close for quite a long time until the children move out, and then you have this other opportunity. The interesting thing is that what happens in this age of opportunity often reflects what the person really thought, okay? You know, for me, I can never go buy, a really nice vehicle or something like that, and so I can be down on people who do that. well, I just simply can't do that, okay? I don't have the money for it. When there's the possibility to do that, the question is, will I? Okay? And so we can pretend, and these are your patrons, okay? They're strapped tight, they're paying tuition, income and expense are the same, you know, and so they're struggling to make it. The true test comes when there's that opportunity. Help your young people see that opportunity as a way to save for the realities that are coming. It might be first of all a vehicle, a good serviceable cheap vehicle that they can run and then save for their housing needs and marriage if that's in their future. The other opportunity that does exist here is time. Okay, they have time to serve because they don't need to earn an income to support a family. So we don't just want to say this is a financial opportunity. There's other opportunities that exist in this, what we call the opportunity of youth. Savings, a wise person looks ahead, identifies a need, and saves for that need. You know, budgeting is kind of a negative word. You know, it's for the loser who can't make things work. But savings, you know, that's what a wise person does. So if you put this out there as, you know, kind of the carrot, you know, if you're wise, the smart person looks ahead and they save. Well, what they're actually doing is budgeting, right? And so put the positive spin on it here, help them to see the opportunity of saving. Debt is a plague in our culture. Define it for students and preach against unsecured debt. So the idea of unsecured debt is simply this. A secured debt is when you borrow money and you have some physical, tangible object to back up that debt. If you can't pay your mortgage, you can sell your house and pay off the debt. Okay? So a secured debt in some cases makes sense. Basically, we're talking about a mortgage, or we're talking about getting a good legitimate business started that has a good business plan that looks like it should work out, okay? This is where we get in trouble. Unsecured debt is personal debt that's not secured by an asset. This is credit card debt. This is paying for ice cream cones and McDonald's meals and mini market things that were purchased last month and now I can't pay them this month. There is nothing to sell to pay off that debt. So help students understand, never, never, never go into that unsecured debt, that personal debt. And we're just simply going to wrap up here. Are you a steward or an owner? And this is a personal question to you because students do reflect us as teachers in their lives. They reflect their parents as well. I believe you as a teacher do have a way to speak to the next generation about things where maybe the older generation has not thought as deeply as they should have. And you can infuse in your students, hopefully, a stewardship attitude. First of all, by example, and then you yourself molding those students to be stewards rather than owners. So hopefully this was helpful, and you can put some of this into practice this school year.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.